Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Committee on the Economy, the committee with the Facebook page. I'm Senator Mia Costello. It's February 16, 2017, and it is 1:32 in the afternoon. I'm joined today by committee members, Senator Gardner, welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer, welcome.
Thanks.
Senator Stevens, welcome. And Vice Chair Senator Hughes, welcome.
Thank you.
So today, I also want to thank the recording secretary and our LIO operator for making this possible. So today we kind of have a treat. I've, for lack of a better word, borrowed some of our presenters from the Innovation Summit that's happening here in Juneau. And that's happening down at Centennial Hall. It's put on by the Juneau Economic Development Corporation, and they bring in speakers each year. And last year we had the featured speaker, and again this year we are joined by the Innovation Summit's featured speaker, Robert Tucker. Welcome. I also want to welcome Senator Begich. She's here. Just having seen our agenda for today, I think you wanted to listen in, and thank you for coming. Following Mr. Tucker, we will have the UAF Vice President of Academic Affairs and Research, Daniel White. Thank you for making yourself available. You are also a significant presenter at the Innovation Summit, so that's the theme today is we're capitalizing on the fact that we have a lot of innovation related interest in what's happening at the summit. So I appreciate you making yourself available. And then later this afternoon we will have the Sand Lake Lions Lego League robotics team members here, and they are from Sand Lake Elementary School, which is in my district. It's the largest elementary school in the state, and they will be presenting to us their project. They were the Global Innovation Award winners at the first Lego League this year, and I thought it would be really interesting for the committee to just to see, get a taste of what our students are doing and how innovation really ties into growing our economy. So I'm really excited about today's order of events. So with that, Mr. Tucker, welcome. Mr. Tucker is a nationally recognized speaker in the area of innovation and entrepreneurship. You've authored 7 books. I've yet to purchase your latest book, but I hope you'll talk to us about it today. And I just wanted to welcome you and give you a chance to talk to the committee members. As I mentioned earlier, this is the Committee on the Economy, and my particular passion as a legislator is growing the economy through innovation. And so with that, I just wanted to open up the floor to you. And members, if you have questions, please feel free to let me know. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Yes, it's very good to be here. It's always good to be in Alaska. I have the privilege of saying that I was a former resident of Alaska. I want you to know this was back in the late 70s. For about 6 weeks, I was based on a ship, a government research vessel off the coast of Kodiak, based out of Kodiak, I should say. So I can honestly say that I was a resident here, and I'm very proud of that fact. Our mutual interest is obviously the economy and innovation as a tool to assist that economy and prospering every citizen. And so what I thought I would do, because I am here to speak and work with the Economic Development Council here of Juneau, is to maybe give you just a taste, if you will, of some of the things that we talked about that are going on at the session or at the conference nearby at Centennial Hall. And then if you have questions, want to follow up, we'll just buzz through. So as an innovation expert, you can't help but get involved in economic development. And I've been these are twin sisters. But I think what's going on with the majority of existing businesses out there today are three essential challenges, and we're just looking at the 30,000-foot level here. One is a lack of growth. I mean, growth has slowed down. It's harder to achieve, whether you're a small business here in Juneau or a large business. So that's one of the things. The other is differentiation. I mean, you see in the press where a big company like Hewlett-Packard is laying off 90,000 workers, and you just kind of gulp, you know, even in relatively good times. And it's because their product is not differentiated from the competition. So what's happening is, you know, there's a sort of a price war going on there among desktops. You see this lack of differentiation in airlines and even in automobiles. I think the big thing, though, that's affecting more and more companies today is what I call the disruption challenge. I don't know if you're seeing that in companies here, but because of the work that I do, I work with so many different industries. It's quite often that it's hidden from the general public. I mean, you don't necessarily think about the local bike retailer or the local retailer here in Juneau or Anchorage or wherever, but there, many of these industries are facing great challenges because of what we might call disruption. It could be an economic change. It could be a technological change. It could be a demographic change. But whatever it is, it's sort of coming at them. And so even milk, for example. I mean, the food milk industry, I don't know if you're aware of this, but is down 36% over the last 15 years. People are just drinking less cow's milk and going for everything from soy milk to almond milk, right? I mean, I would say, who knew that almonds had udders, but, you know, hey, you heard it here first. So again, what I do as a researcher and a consultant is to research the world's most innovative companies. I was just in China last year. We were studying companies like Tencent and Xiaomi and many others. And we try to find what are these companies doing that's working and what's not working, really. I mean, what's beyond the academic theory. And then we assist companies really throughout the world in 48 countries in coming up with a better innovation process. So here I'm in Bahrain where it's 140 degrees outside. I don't know if it reaches that temperature in here in Alaska, but in South Africa with a mining company. And what we find, you know, here's a Hong Kong insurance company and a bank in Panama. And what we find is that there's no one-size-fits-all when you're trying to help a company to be more innovative. It's not like you can apply a cookie-cutter approach. But what we see in common is that the most innovative companies out there do a number of things in common. They treat innovation as a strategic imperative, as a top priority, and it's got to be driven from the top, we find. It can't be something delegated. They also have a closeness to their customers that is uncanny. They invent by starting with the customer and starting backwards. And instead of saying, hey, what are we going to make off of this idea? And I think that's a significant thing there. You've got to be very, very customer-focused and oriented in this time of disruption, because one minute you're adding value for the customer, whether that's a tourist on a cruise ship off the coast here coming in to Juneau, or a customer being that oil tanker heading off to India or some other port. The customer's needs are changing in a very, I want to say, volatile world, but a very rapidly changing, rapidly evolving world. So maybe 15, 20 years ago or so, I started getting speaking invitations from various ministries of industry, so sort of your counterpart, if you will, in places like Taiwan. And they were starting to become interested in innovation. And that trend has, here I am in Russia, St. Petersburg, Russia, with invited to speak at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. This is back in 2009 when relations were a bit better with Russia, but speaking on the power of innovation and leading a thing there. So while economic development is not my primary thrust, it is certainly an area of interest. And as I approached this particular project with working with the JEDC, I did a lot of research, and I just kind of collected some of these headlines. And these are nothing here is anything of news to you all. It's just, this is kind of what's out there on the internet, or this is what, you know, the public, those who still read, at least, are hearing and seeing about Alaska and about Juneau in particular. But having come here and just talking to lots and lots of the movers and shakers of Alaska and people who are, you know, self-select to come to this innovation conference, I can't help but see that you are at an economic crossroads here, and maybe a social crossroads as well. And I think in these periods of maybe we call it a disruption or maybe we call it an inflection point, I think it calls upon all of us, and especially those in leadership, to try to see out ahead of the future and make the kind of choices that are in the best interest of the future of this great state. And I've been very, very, very impressed with the caliber and the talent, the caliber of people that you have here. The humility, I would say, is one of the things that I notice. There's just a genuineness and an authenticity. And perhaps that's because of the harsh climate, at least in the wintertime. Perhaps that's just because people who self-selected to come here are the genuine article. There's not a lot of Hollywood types here, but I find it very, very refreshing. And I find people really pondering this juncture, this fork in the road, this place that you are at this moment, and really trying to unleash a spirit of innovation. And I know this is, you've been here before, and the 80s were tough, but I don't think that the kind of recovery that was achieved then will be the same this time. And so it's up to the pioneers, the legislators, the governor, the movers and shakers, the business community to come together. And because of the work that I do in innovation, you know, I deal with innovation on the personal level as well as the organizational, as well as the, you know, country or state level. And it all comes back to what is the mindset that we're looking at these issues and problems from. If we're in defeatist mode, basically our idea factory is shut down. We're not able to really come up with the ideas that could help us to succeed. And I think given the problems that the governor was alluding to in this morning's paper about opiate use and so forth, I think a lot of people are trying to cope with all the changes that are going on out there by escaping. And then there's, of course, the sustainer mode, and this is a mode where, you know, we sort of, and I certainly want to include myself in this, but we can get into an attitude of, well, you know, been there, done that, right? And we can shoot down ideas, anything that's new, whether it's crowdfunding or anything else, so we can say, well, you know, that's not going to work here. Dreamer mode is like having ideas, but there's not an intention to act on those. And then finally, opportunity mode. I always say that the difference there is that when we're in opportunity mode, not only are we coming up with ideas and visions and concepts about how things can be improved and so forth, but we are willing and ready to take action. All over, again, as I say, we see disruption, and it's, you know, it's almost as if the social and societal changes. I mentioned bicycle dealers. I happened to work with the independent bike dealers in Las Vegas last year. And when you delve into an industry's challenges, right, you start seeing, wow, that all of this technology and all of this social media and all this sort of thing is really creating new winners and losers at a much more rapid pace. So I think not everybody. Here's a company that I interviewed, and Jim and Christy Erickson run a business. They're not looking to grow. They're not looking to transform this business. They're very happy. They've got a great niche in the market. They're a sort of a mid-sized processor. You probably know them. But when I interview them, you know, I understand it. I got it. You're not trying to become the next IBM. You're just trying to, you know, have a great business here, and you do. But I said, what does innovation mean to you? And they said, we're just trying to do more with what we've got. And I said, well, can you give me an example? And they said, yeah. We used to just basically take the byproduct of our processing and dump that back in the ocean. Today, we sell that to a pet food product company, and it drops a couple of $1 million to the bottom line there. And so that is the kind of example. Now, I always look back, well, where did that idea come from? And so what I do in life, what I get to do, is to inspire people to have more of these kinds of ideas, right? That's it. Most businesses, however, the rate of change outside is perhaps faster than the rate of innovation inside, and so if they don't pick up the pace there, then they're going to be disrupted. I should have started with this slide, but it's not too late. People ask me, what is innovation? And I say it's introducing a new product or a process or a strategy that creates new value for the customer, which in turn drives growth for us and for our company. So we got to create the value for the customer first before then we receive it, not the other way around. I think a lot of people get confused about that. You see the results of various CEOs, the past six CEOs at a big company like Procter & Gamble. They make Tide soap and Crest toothpaste and so forth. And, you know, it's what the CEO did to achieve this kind of incredible return. But this was a company that was mired in bureaucracy when he took over. They hadn't had any growth there. Margins were thinning out. And he basically started giving out rewards to people with ideas. He pioneered what they call open innovation. They started really emphasizing emerging markets. So it's the actions that they took. And probably the most significant was he said, we're going to sort of make innovation everybody's business. And this we find is a trend in a lot of the progressive companies. They're sort of deputizing everybody to search for ideas, to search for better ways, to search for lower cost ways of getting the job done. He says, when I became CEO, we had 8,000 R&D people working on innovation. Today, all employees are expected to understand the role that they play. And I think that's sort of the metaphor. I, again, work with a lot of different industries, the ski industry, they're flat, aging boomers, the climate change sometimes wreaks havoc. And what you always find when you look hard enough at an industry are what are the more innovative companies in that industry doing to thrive and to regenerate. And so, for example, Whistler, a famous resort in Canada, began rethinking what they're doing in the summer. These were sort of dormant months, quiet months, no skiing. And they said, let's start holding various festivals to attract people to the mountain. And today they have the largest BMX Crankworks competition for these bicycle competitors. Another resort said, maybe not everybody wants to ski, but let's create a resort year-round, a water park, and go at it that way. One Vermont resort said, you know, the conference business might be a way to fill beds during the middle of the week when the skiers are home and back at the office working. I have a lot of travel and was invited not long ago to speak in Medellin, Colombia. And if you're of an age, you would recognize the name Medellin, Colombia as the murder capital of the world, right? And it was in the 70s and 80s. And into the early 90s there, it was basically ruled by a drug cartel headed by Pablo Escobar. And poverty and fear was rampant. And I use this example because it's economic development. It's a success story. The poverty rates were, I think, over 80% at one point there. But through public-private partnerships, through economic development, through the efforts of bodies just like this, they began to question the status quo. And in 93, Escobar was killed in a police shootout, and these public-private partnerships and these economic development efforts, I won't go through all of them, but microfinance, probably the biggest one, the one that they're sort of known for, is this idea they took from the ski industry. to use these gondolas. These poor people were spending as much as an hour a day each way walking up and down these hills. They don't own cars, no buses up in there. So they were taking the groceries. They just built this series of escalators and gondola cars. So sometimes the solution to the problems that people have are like staring us right in the face. And so they took action. These people, Citizens United, they just began to take action and take action and take action. And today, 24 years later, poverty is down, crime is down, and education is up, and civic pride is up. I can't tell you. We were led around on a tour. There were a number of dignitaries there from all over the world to help them celebrate. In 2013, Medellin was named the world's most innovative city by the Urban Land Institute. And so it's a very inspiring story there of what they call social innovation. Companies, for example, if you go back to the Great Recession here for just a moment, 2008, 2009, automobiles, if you were in that industry, you're down 30 to 50%. But there was one car company that was actually showing a sales increase. They were up 14% during this period. And, of course, as an innovation expert, what I wanted to know was why were they up when everyone else was down? And it turned out they asked a different series of questions. And that's often the key to engendering engendering innovative thinking. Everyone was asking, how much more do we need to rebate to get cars moving again? But Hyundai said, why aren't people buying cars? And that opened up a whole new space for them. They're not buying cars because they're afraid they'll lose their job in the next 12 months. So let's do something we've never thought to do. Let's do a one-year no-cost return guarantee. If you lose your job in the next 12 months, you can bring the car back. An unconventional solution for unconventional challenging times. So the point is that, and maybe I should end up here so we have plenty of time for questions if there are any. My point is that by innovative thinking, by using innovative thinking, by inspiring innovative thinking, all the way from the very beginning, from the early childhood education, all the way through to the university, we've got to do certain things differently because you are in a period that is uncharted. It's a complete, and history will show. History will look back at the decisions that you all make here and that economic development groups make in behalf of your citizens. I'm not going to go through all of these. I wish we had more time, but this is the kinds of things that we get into with our customers and clients to give them a sense. But I will comment on this one just briefly and on this one as well. This was a young fellow who won an award or presented actually this morning, one of many entrepreneurs that are presenting briefly over here at the conference. This gentleman just started this company, I believe, last year, he told the audience. And I've been thinking a lot about folks like this because what we find is that, you know, you look around and you think, well, all these millennials are starting businesses everywhere. It's not true. It is not true. According to the Wall Street Journal analysis of Federal Reserve data, the share of young people, people under 30, who own private businesses, is at a 24-year low. We've got to understand why that's the case, because these folks are the future. And we happen to have over at the conference here some folks who are just leading the way. And we've got to figure out how to nurture these people. Is it funding they need? Is it knowledge they need? Is it a helping hand they need? Because starting a business today has never been more complicated. And so some of the agencies, government and nonprofit that are coming alongside, such as this Arctic Innovation Competition, right, to give out a small reward, actually in this case not so small, $10,000 to this team. And there was another competition just last night. So these kind of things encourage our young people. And we get to talking about ideas and people start seeing new needs. Hey, I could do this. We could do that. And so that's the kind of thing that I want to encourage. I'm going to zoom forth here, although I'd love to tell you these great stories, but I'm mindful of your time. This is a very rough draft. I basically just thought, you know, it's maybe worth it to just put down a few thoughts here about that might serve as some sort of guidance to you in terms of handling this inflection point. I would declare the year of innovation as soon as you possibly can. I know that's got to be a joint effort and a collaborative effort, but I think there are so many green shoots happening with respect to innovation, and it's also new, but I think letting the general public know. So recognizing and promoting the state's innovation sector, and that's anybody who's starting a business or is thinking about starting a business at the kitchen table, in the garage, we don't care where they're starting it. We want to find you and we want to help you, in my humble opinion. We need to help communities transition from, you know, as you say, resource dependent to value adding. Diversification, I know it is not a new word here in Alaska, but as someone said last night from the speaker platform, when does Alaska talk about or think about economic development? When oil prices are under $40 a barrel? When do we not think about it and talk about it? When oil prices rise above that? I don't know what oil prices are going to do. I don't think anybody really does, but I think to count on them coming back to 100, 140 a barrel anytime soon is probably not the best bet. Partnering and collaborating with federal and state government entities. I think this collaboration and partnering should be put on steroids. Promoting education and retraining. We're going to need so much retraining. Robotics and all these things that are going to take over. Lifelong learning needs to be more than just a cliche or a nice sentiment. It needs to be the essence of what all of us do. And then finally, partnering with and promoting these millennial startups that I was just mentioning there. So with that, I will conclude my remarks. And if Madam Chairman, if you have any questions or members of the committee, I would be more than happy to try to entertain them.
Thank you so much, Mr. Tucker. I have not seen this room be so quiet in such a very long time, just listening intently to every word you said. And I think your experience is certainly tremendous, and the fact that you're here talking to us today is a real treat for us. At least I can speak for myself, and I'm sure my members here also feel the same way. So it looks like you do have a question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you very much. I share the passion that the chair has, and in fact, just a little earlier today, I had an interview with Discover Magazine because I've kind of helped open up the unmanned aircraft field as an emerging technology that I felt we needed to take advantage of. And I had read a few books a couple summers ago, and I was pulling it up, and the millennial entrepreneur question, I'd like your advice, and if any states are doing anything in particular, because it was either, that used to be us by Thomas Friedman, you're probably familiar with some of these, the Global Achievement Gap by Tony Wagner, or the Coming Job War by Jim Clifton. And one of the things pinpointed, and I don't remember which one it was what we need to do is when kids, during the K-12 process, we need to identify the kids that are the future innovators, entrepreneurs. And that's what built our country. That's what made us great. And we get worried about SAT scores and doing all these other measurements. But what we need to do is come up with a way to assess which students have the right characteristics, somebody that's willing to take risks and fail and get back up again, the creative thinkers, and really try to find out who those students are and support them in the middle school and high school years. Have you heard of any place where they've successfully figured out how to do that and are doing that? Because I think that would feed in to the millennial entrepreneur piece that you were talking about.
Well, thank you for the question, Madam Chairman and Senator Hughes. That's a great question, and it's not one I can definitely sort of parse in a quick manner. But I on the one hand, you want to, you know, sort of unleash and help all students to unleash their potential in this regard. And I certainly don't disagree that there are those among us who just have this bent toward either entrepreneurship or toward unleashing their creativity. I think we have some very good efforts. Dean Kamen has you may know that name. He's the guy that invented the Segway and other types of products. There are a lot of budding programs for young engineers. In fact, you're going to hear from some budding engineers in just a moment here in the robotics sense. So I think we need to encourage those kinds of things. I also, though, feel like the arts have gotten short shrifted in recent years, and so that the left brain may be have been entertained, but the right brain, you know, the creative and intuitive side of the brain, maybe need a little remedial work there. I noticed in our young people that creativity is actually, as well as empathy, both of those are measurably diminished. And so if I were to sort of be able to wave a magic wand and design a curriculum all the way from the very beginning here, I think it would be to help all children to understand that we all have different capacities, we have different propensities. About 50% of the adult population, for example, is very much more comfortable improving the situation or the condition or whatever it is. And then about 50%, according to research out of the UK by a man by the name of Professor Curtin, K-I-R-T-I-N, shows that some are willing to just, you know, basically change the system. They're very comfortable with that. And so we all have different makeups. It's like being left-handed or right-handed. But I think in the world that's emerging here, we're going to need people with both, right? We're going to need to marry the technology and the engineering, those people, with those people who are empathetic, and especially and able to really understand experience. If we just relate this to something more present in terms of one of the clusters, the tourist cluster, this is an area where you can greatly expand even further. I mean, the number of cruise ship people coming through here, including my wife and I several years ago, about a million two. And you can double that and triple that because people want this authentic experience, the wildlife that you have here and so forth. So when we start, you know, brainstorming about these kind of things, it goes far beyond your question about curriculum. But it's releasing that passion and then just going with what you've got here in terms of your natural resources and your human resources in the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. It was very enlightening and thought-provoking. But I guess my question is, why are we afraid to fail? Because it seems like we reward success. And when people try something new and different and they fail, they're kind of looked upon like that was dumb. And wouldn't you agree that most new projects or new businesses that people start more fail than succeed? And I think sometimes we're held back because of the stigma in our culture, in our society, that failure is bad. And I know even as elected officials, you know, the state has done big mega projects, and some of them have failed. And we keep hearing about those all the time, about, don't do that. Remember that last project you did, it failed. And we don't remember the successes we've had. And so I think, at least the people I talk to, and I like your point about innovation starts at the top, and we may not be at the top, but we're the board of directors, so we're up there. If, you know, some will look at the governor as the CEO. And I think we're all in tune with the customers, our constituents. But yet I think sometimes we're held back because we don't want to fail.
Again, thank you, Senator. That's a topic. If you're into the innovation, that's a topic that comes up a lot. How to deal with failure and so forth. So there's so much to be said. I mean, for example, in Silicon Valley, it's a badge of honor to have failed. In fact, they don't really take you seriously unless you failed a couple of times. So it's maybe geographic specific, but among the millennials, we're seeing, as we really sort of try to understand them as people, that there is a risk averseness. They don't want to fail. They've come through an educational system that rewards, you know, get the answer right here, otherwise you don't get to go to college, or you don't get to go to a good college, or whatever that happens to be. And so they're facing a world that is phenomenally more complex than, say, the boomer generation. Coming of age has always been a challenge, right? I mean, one CEO of a company that employs a lot of millennials and Gen Xers said to me, you know, Robert, they're suffering a post-adolescent identity crisis. You know, just, I mean, I don't know about you, but I know my own adolescence, you know, just trying to. And then on top of that, technology and social change is happening at this rate that nobody can really cope with it. So if the impact of that is to be risk-averse from a very early age, then all bets are off. And so, to your point, Senator, I hope that we can make it okay to fail. Some companies, for example, Intuit, celebrate failure. Get it out in the open. I've been called into companies as I won't mention names, but they said, Robert, there's some urban legend that somebody got punished for failure in this division of this giant company. Come up and help us to sort this thing out. So, yes, it is a problem that besets. People don't want to let their, in a big company, just they don't want to let their colleagues down. So, you know, why stick your neck out if, in fact, your idea were to fail? And so that has to be made right with the company. But, I mean, you know, with the culture, because you can have a company, a culture that's very loyal, but it's not an innovative culture. It's an anti-innovative culture, because to be an innovative culture, you do have to have people taking risks. You cannot condone risk averseness. Everybody has to have skin in the game. So these are issues that leaders really need to be clear on and understand, and what they're putting out in terms of a culture of innovation. Because if the leader says, you know, sure, we want innovation and let's celebrate it, and then, as one said in a closed circuit television hookup to a meeting offsite of his middle managers, but make your numbers, and then he cut the plug and he was gone, right? And so it's like we're left there with, oh, okay, you know, right? Who's going to go first here? All the air went out of the room. So, so it's an important issue. So maybe we need to think about this from all the way back in school. You know, how we deal with failure and how we deal with and encouraging people to take risks.
Any further questions from committee members? I just have one final question for you. And again, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
What is grit?
Well, in the South, we used to have grits for breakfast. No, I'm sorry. Grit, I look at grit as bravery, taking risks, meeting the challenge, stepping up to the challenges that we face. Every generation, I mean, you think of the pioneers that settled Alaska and then our own challenges. I mean, there's never been a generation that didn't have challenges. But I think grit is a great word to focus on in terms of what we're about and what we need to spawn. Because, again, as I said earlier, I think future generations will look back at the kind of decisions that you all need to make here. And may they look at those decisions and say, yes, we were at a fork in the road. There were some very tough issues there that had to be wrestled with. And I am just hoping that, unlike Washington that the people of Alaska and the leaders will take a different course and not be polarized and divided and allow those kinds of things to keep us from doing our best thinking, giving it our best shot, and using grit every step of the way.
Well, thank you so much. Really, it's been a treat to have you here, and I will be looking at your book. And I know you have seven of them, so books, I guess. But, you know, I hope you have a safe trip home. I think that your presentation has been, you know, very informative and thought-provoking for us today. So
thank you.
Thank you. And we will take a brief at ease, and then Daniel White will be our next guest. Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, the Committee on the Economy. And with us now, we have Dr. Daniel White, the Vice President of Academic Affairs and Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and want to warmly welcome you to the committee. And again, we are dovetailing off of the Innovation Summit that the Juneau Economic Development Corporation is putting on right now, happening at Centennial Hall in Juneau. But thank you so much for coming here, and I want to give you the floor and let members know that if you have questions, please let me know. Welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dan White. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Research for the University of Alaska System. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak. It is just really a great pleasure for me to get the opportunity to talk about two of my favorite things to talk about, the university and research. Economic development, research into economic development. University of Alaska is a resource for economic development. It's your resource. And it was just 6 years ago or so that we underwent a major transformation, and I think we talked about that, Senator Hughes and Senator Costello, some years ago as we just started that transformation, and it's really starting to make a difference. And I'll reference, eight new companies UAF started. I'll talk about four new companies that UAA started. These are the first products of this major effort to make innovation everybody's business. We have taken that seriously. It is promoted throughout the universities. Innovation is everybody's business. And just as an example, of course, I used to be at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and managed the intellectual property there. And as we went around, we had a history of a couple of inventions a year for decades, two or three or four. And we went around and we said, here's what an invention is, and here's what it means. It could be anything. It doesn't have to be a new discovery. It's a new process that you came up with. Here's what it means. Here's what it means to you as an inventor, and here's what it means to the university and the economy. And the next year, there were 50 people came out and said, well, I have an invention. And the next year, 75 more people came out and said, well, I have an invention. And in 2015, UAF licensed 51 pieces of intellectual property to companies. Companies in Alaska, I think there were a couple companies, Northrop Grumman, outside of Alaska, but 32 pieces of intellectual property went to one of the university's startups. So it is starting to make a difference. And when when we look at Silicon Valley, I mean, that's there because of Stanford. You look at the Research Triangle, there's big tech development there. That's there because of research universities, North Carolina. These kinds of big economic engines, even if you look at Washington State University, similar Pullman, similar kind of environment to Alaska, fairly a little bit rural. There is a company, has a great big building, has hundreds of employees worldwide, Schweitzer Engineering. Just a professor came up with a digital, actually he was a student at the time, came up with a digital relay. And every relay in Alaska is that digital relay. These are relays for power grids that they came up with, and that's a company right now that sits on a hill above Washington State University. And I think we have that opportunity in Alaska, and I think this is the time, and the groundwork, as I said, I think has been laid, and we're starting to see that. So,
Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and I apologize for interrupting, but I just have to ask, what happened to start this, you said 6 years ago or 8 years ago. What was the trigger?
Well, I think there were a number of things. I think one is leadership. I think at UAF, Brian Rogers said, we need to change the way we're doing things. Helena Wisniewski, as you know, joined UAA, and there was just a change. And I'll just give you, if you'll indulge me for a second, a brief example. As a faculty, I was an engineering faculty for many years. One of the gold mines came and said, we've got this problem with waste cyanide, because they use cyanide in the heap leach process to get the gold out of the rock. And we've got this problem because the cyanide has to be disposed of, and it's expensive to dispose of. What could you do? We were working with wastewater treatment plants at the time, and we said, well, we've got these biological processes. Let's see if we can feed it to the bacteria, and they'll just break apart the cyanide, and we'll all be done, and it'll be really cheap. And we did that, and we discovered that, well, actually, we're only about 88% of the gold that the company extracts is recovered, and a lot of it is still bound up in the cyanide. Well, we were plating, gold was covering all kinds of things in our glassware, because as we destroyed the cyanide, then the gold came out of that. And so we said, well, here's a great process. And I got a provisional patent on it. And then we didn't do anything. And we said, well, we'll just publish it, because that's what we do as a university. We publish stuff. And later I was talking to some gold companies, and they said, Dan, you didn't commercialize it. Because we can't take the idea. We need to buy a product. And at that point, for me anyway, I realized that that's the big gap for us at the university, is saying we've got great ideas, hundreds of great ideas every year. We've got to get those. Lots of them are going to fail, as Robert said, but we've got to get those into something somebody can buy and into a company that can make money with it. As soon as you get it into a company that can make money with it, that's great for the university, it's great for the inventor, and it's great for the consumer. So I think there was some leadership changes that made that happen. Gatorade, of course, everybody knows Gatorade, and I it just started as a drink for the replenish salts for football players at the University of Florida, and still, University of Florida gets a check of $12 million a year in just royalties from selling Gatorade. And, those are the home runs, and we might get some home runs, but I think if we start a whole bunch of companies in Alaska that make money, even if they're not Gatorade, I think that would be great. It would be great for the university, and it would be great for all of us as citizens of Alaska. Sorry, I'm still on the first slide, but this is such a fun thing to talk about. But, the University of Alaska does rough numbers, $110 million of research. And a lot of times we talk about, that's a great investment for the state. The state allocation for research is in rough numbers $25 million. And then that money is leveraged with research grants to add up to about $110. And we talk about that that is a great thing. That is money that's going into the economy. Most all of that is spent in the local economies of Alaska. But that, to me, is just the tip of the iceberg. That is great research, but now think of all the ideas that we could get out of that and get into companies that know how to make money with it. You mentioned, Senator Hughes, just earlier, these unmanned aircraft. And we have a startup company in Fairbanks now that's looking at developing different pieces and parts for these unmanned aircraft on the physical side, on the infrastructure side of how to make these things better. But we also have teams that are flying these out. There's a couple pictures there, flying them out over walruses to count walruses for fish and wildlife. Much safer for Alaskans out there flying, instead of a manned aircraft that's going to fly into stormy weather. Let's send an unmanned aircraft. They're cheap, and they don't bother the animals. All kinds of opportunities that now can turn into businesses, and there's several of these businesses that are not directly intellectual property of the university, but are benefiting just because of this research is there. And that's kind of that Silicon Valley effect. The Center for Energy and Power, this is something that's at the University of Alaska, and this image is just a picture of a boiler. The fire in the corner there, lower left corner, is the fire in your boiler. Everybody's got a boiler, and we do that across our state, is generate steam to generate electricity, and we boil the water goes up, we extract, either use it to drive a turbine and get electricity or extract heat from it, and that then leaves us with some really low temperature, it's high temperature water, but it's not enough to get any energy out of it, and the university is developing new ways of extracting more energy out of that, and we need that in Alaska. Robert, at his talk at the Innovation Summit, mentioned happy accidents. It's a lot of these companies that have started. I mean, Teflon was a happy accident, right? They weren't trying to make Teflon. They weren't trying to make the microwave when the microwave was invented. Those are things that just happened, and they said, wow, this is a great product. And this is in this research where the university was saying, let's get more energy or more heat out of kind of the bottom end of this heat cycle. And they said, in order to do that, we need to have a better understanding of how much fuel we're using. And so they invented a new method of measuring fuel more accurately. And now they're getting hundreds of requests for this fuel meter. And so we're patenting the fuel meter and getting it to a company that can then make these fuel meters and sell them all over the world. You know, they're a little fuel meter. It may not be a big thing. I hope it's a great big thing, but it's a start. But it starts with research. It's fundamental research. It's applied research. You know, I think of we've got fundamental researchers that are looking at hibernation. Hibernation is understanding what the physiological changes are in an animal that undergoes hibernation, and why is that important? It's important, and this is work that's being done at UAA and UAF. It's important because if there's battlefield injuries, stroke, heart attacks, traumatic brain injury, if you could just cool the body and you know your body, if you're in a traumatic, if you have a traumatic injury, your body starts putting stuff back together, and your brain is doing triage. It's putting stuff back together as fast as it possibly can, and it's not that accurate as it does that. What if we could slow the body down? And this is evidence that the University of Alaska has done. Let's slow the body down. Let's cool the body. The body is a lot more deliberate when it's cold. It's not frantically putting things back. And the accuracy that things get put back together is higher. So people have a much better chance of kind of recovering from these injuries in that situation. Well, here's the problem. The problem is my body was not designed to be cooled, and your body will automatically go into thermogenesis. You'll start shivering because your body is trying to heat up, even though the doctors are trying to cool you, and you have a heart attack. People will go into cardiac arrest if they're cooled. So one of the companies that's been formed at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is to develop drugs that tell your body you're cool. Even though you're not. Your body thinks it's cool, it starts being more deliberate, slows down, puts things back together more accurately, and you don't have a heart attack because your body's not really cool. Anyway, these are the kinds of transformative things that's really basic research, but it's a company. It could be applied research like this energy stuff. We just need a better heat fuel monitor. Applied research, basic research, it all has an opportunity. And this is just a picture of you know, the University of Alaska has worked on this state digital elevation map. That's leading to products. Engineers and the miners are looking at that and saying, we could put together a plan that software that layers that information with the information we had on minerals and be more deliberate and more accurate about where we find new discoveries. I covered this. What are the benefits? I think it's obviously good for the university because it returns royalties. It's good for the inventors. We have the most favorable, in my opinion, the most favorable royalty sharing agreement with faculty of any university that I've looked at. Now, what we do is we say the inventor gets all of the first $10,000 that's made on a product and 50% of all royalties after that. So if we get $12 million for Gatorade, $6 million goes to the inventor, the faculty, staff, or student that did that development. Other universities, it peters out. When you get up to $12 million, it's, you know, $500,000 for the inventor. And so we have a great incentive. And as a consumer, boy, I wish our university were turning things out every single day that I could buy because it's better for me. And obviously, we need the jobs and we need the money in the economy. So how does this all happen? Starts with a need. Somebody is doing research at the university, and again, it's faculty, it's staff, and it's students. And another part of Bob Tucker's talk that he didn't get a chance to talk about today is it's a lot of times somebody who is working in the mailroom or working out in a field camp that sees the problems every day, that comes up with the solutions and says, you know what, researcher, here's a solution that's going to fix a lot of things that I've been observing. So it's everybody. It's everybody's business. But that need is identified. Then there's some research done. An inventor comes into the intellectual property office and says, you know what, here's an invention. Tell me about it. There's an attorney there that says, it's already been done. It's not an invention. It has been done. In fact, we, when I'm out in Kodiak, the folks there said, boy, we wish we had a way to deal with arrow-tooth flounder.
Yes.
And we happen to have an inventor who came up with a way to make mayonnaise out of arrow-tooth flounder. You need that kind of whatever it is, gelatinous material. Great invention, but the claims, we couldn't get the claims worked out. So some of these things don't work out, but if we get enough of that stuff in, it's going to stick. And it is starting to stick. So that's what that technology assessment is. Protect it. That can be done by trade secret, copyright, patent. It's not always patents. Patents are expensive. But that's a key piece that we had been missing that we're not missing anymore. And then marketing, licensing, get it out to somebody who can make money with it. It's a lot of talking. It's a lot of identifying somebody going out and saying, you know what you've got right there is an invention. Lots of people have developed things they don't know yet are inventions until somebody kind of explains what's protectable. Supporting then these faculty-led companies. This is a diagram. This is how the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'll show UAA's model. And UAS also has developments because the number is smaller. Typically, UAF has developed their or done their technology assessment for them. But the inventors within the university talk to an attorney at the Office of Intellectual Property. And then that goes to a company. We formed a nonprofit company, and this is very similar to UAA's. A nonprofit company that can, if it can find a business, if it says, you know, there's already a business in Kodiak that does this, let's get the technology to them. We don't need to get a startup to compete with them. Let's just get the technology to them. If there's not a business, and the university says, or this innovation corporation says, we need a new business, they get the technology into the hands of a for-profit company called Nanook Tech Ventures that then will create the company, take some equity in the company, and get things moving. And a great example of that is a company called ViaDapt, which was recognized last night at the Innovation Summit. The inventor there looked at ash clouds of volcanic eruptions, and they can predict where the ash cloud is going. And if they can do that, they can get that information to the airlines. The airlines don't have to shut down all of their airspace. They don't have to say, we don't want to risk anything. We just don't want to fly right through the cloud. And we know where it's going, so we can still get passengers and freight and cargo where it needs to go. So that's an example of a startup company. I mentioned the thermogenesis, that's that body cooling. Dynamic mill simulator for Alaskan mines, that's something, again, that was recognized. The innovator was recognized last night. This is just a snapshot, and I mentioned on the far left of the screen is the technologies assigned for licensing, 51 in 2015, 6 in 2014. Those numbers just continue to grow, which I think is a great thing. And these are some of the companies that have come out of University of Alaska Fairbanks. These are faculty who are starting companies. This is not even the things have been licensed to existing companies. Be Cool, that's the one where they're developing the pharmaceuticals to convince your brain that you're cool. The third one is not on here, but these are two of the inventors that were recognized last night at the Innovators Hall of Fame celebration. Dr. Rajiv Ganguly on the lower left, who developed the mill simulator, and Jeff Rothman on the right. And he's holding in his right hand a hockey puck-sized listening device. And this listening device, of course, they were developed at the university for nuclear test ban treaty monitoring. We need somebody to tell us if a nuclear explosion was detonated underground in some foreign country. And this can do that. And the arrays are big, the array meaning a series of microphones. And the old style are big, like kind of the size of your table. They got them down to a bit smaller. But if the military wants to deploy these listening devices, because they hear all kinds of stuff, in a war zone, they need to be really small. So this inventor said, well, we can figure this out, and came up with a small one that could go in backpacks. They could be distributed. They could be dumped from airplanes and really change the way we understand battlefields, disasters, kind of when when the asteroid hit Russia a couple of years ago, we heard the asteroid hit Russia with these things. So we heard that, and then the next day they heard it again because the sound went all the way around the world, and we still heard the sound in the other ear the next day. So interesting ability. Investing. And this is a leadership investment, supporting the innovators, making sure that they have what they need to the risk tolerance, in essence, to say, yeah, if it doesn't work, that's okay. We're going to celebrate failure. I mentioned this is a volcanic app, ash monitoring company, VADAPT. And, the really nice thing, if we could kind of generate the halo effect is other companies saying, I want to be in this ecosystem because even if I'm not using that directly, I'm going to be selling products to this other company that is using the university directly. And we're starting to see that. There's lots of grants for small companies through the federal government. I mentioned there the SBIR and STTR are federal programs to get money into small companies. Particularly ones that partner with universities. So there's some opportunity there. And there are faculty, is at UAF, but both UAF and UAA faculty who have said, I want to go to the University of Alaska because I see this as an innovative culture. This particular faculty said, made his decision to come to UAF because he had some intellectual property he wanted to develop in the University of Alaska. Fairbanks, in his case, said, we welcome that. We're a risk-tolerant culture for doing research and generating these ideas. UAA, very similar structure, and we work together on lots of things. That they have kind of in Anchorage a little different kind of research and community ecosystem, and so the two are working with their business ecosystems to try to get as much intellectual property into the hands of businesses as possible. A couple just slides here from UAA. UAA set up infrastructures, kind of Seawolf infrastructure. They give out awards, innovate awards, to try to stimulate innovation. There's a nice, if you get a chance to go into the UAA admin building, kind of wall of fame where they have all these inventions. This is another thing, kind of thinking back to Robert's talk of celebrating success, celebrating failure, and saying, you know, we recognize these right outside the chancellor's office. That's where their wall of fame is. This is important to us as a university. Over 75% of provisional filings at UAA have evolved into non-provisional. The difference there is if you think you've got a great idea, we file a provisional patent. Some patents cost couple hundred thousand dollars to file. So what you do is you put your stake in the ground with a provisional patent, which you can do yourself. The university can do it without expense, except for somebody filling out the paperwork. And then we spend a year. You have 1 year to deal with that, where it's yours. If you don't do something in a year, it's public domain. But so UAA recognizes and says 75% are going to patent, which means that they're doing a good job of vetting these things coming in because they're having a very high success rate. First four startups, notice there. I'll skip over this, but it's the same kind of structure. Gets all the IP into a holding company that then can evaluate that and either license it to a company or create a startup. And then UAA has a couple of ways of trying to get some equity into these companies. Like I said, Seawolf Holdings is their company that holds the intellectual property. And that's a useful thing. Universities across the country, and this is one of those transformations, Senator Hughes is saying, we as a one big important step for universities across the country was getting IP kind of developed in the university, but then getting it out where there can be a nimble licensing, working with business on kind of on the terms of business. And we didn't do that at UAA and UAF until this transformation. And that is kind of a national model that then we followed. Rhizoform is one of UAA's startups, was just named one of the top 36 best university startups in a National Council of Entrepreneurial Tech Transfer event. Insulation and packaging, using biomaterial for insulation and packaging. Got an opportunity because of this award to go to Washington, D.C. and be celebrated. CFT Solutions, this is a good Alaskan company to thaw roadways, driveways, walkways using carbon fiber tapes. I mentioned both UAF and UAA have startup companies that develop different aspects of the Alaska blueberry and its neurological benefits. And then sensors, and this is a company called Zensor, which is a sensor product DOT would use to understand the roadway, understand buildings. So this is the final slide, and just like to again take the opportunity to say thank you. I think what we need, to Robert's point, mentorship. Lots of these new companies need mentors. They need business mentors. They need investment, but I think there is investment capital in Alaska. It's giving them an investable opportunity. And it came up last night. It came up today. Confidence. I think, one thing that we need is inventors being celebrated, inventors having some confidence and saying, you know what, I'm going to do this, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to try something different, try a little bit different angle. Maybe change the mayonnaise to tartar sauce or something and use the arrow-tooth flounder. But anyway, so I think we're getting there. I think we will continue to grow these operations and hopefully we'll have the Gatorade someday or what it is, and we'll be talking about that. So thank you again, Senator Costello, for the invitation.
Thank you very much, Dr. White. I mean, this has been very fascinating, and I think you have some questions. So, Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it was excellent. Thank you. You mentioned that the provisional patents, 75% of them become non-provisional, and they're vetted well, but you also mentioned that it can cost a couple hundred thousand dollars for those non-provisional patents. Where is that money coming from? Are you having conversations with investors and companies at that point? And then as when I mentioned conversations with companies, I'm also wondering, are you having regular conversations with industry about things that they need? You did mention that's happened along the way. I just wonder if that's regularly happening.
Yes, thank you for the question through the chair. The cost associated with patenting, it varies quite a bit. I think the highest is a couple hundred thousand, and And there's various places where it could come from, and specifically on those that UIA was referring to. I don't know their cost structure on those, but we always look for the user or the licensee to pay some patent fees. And in fact, they, in most cases, want to pay the patent fees or the patent development costs. And one of the reasons is that, you know, we've gone, when I started as the intellectual property director at UAF, you know, we looked in the patent cupboard because we actually had patents. And I went to companies and I said, hey, you know, we have this patent. It's on, we had a patent on using French fry grease for asphalt or something to that effect. And a lot of the companies said, you know what, that would be great, but that's not exactly the patent we want. We like the idea, but, you know, a patent is very much about the claims that the patent protects, right? We claim the invention of these specific things. And most companies will say, especially big companies, will say, we want in before you patent it because we want the claims that fit our company, and we want to modify those claims so that they fit. So we always say in the triage space, as we say right now, who potentially could license this, and can we get them in early enough to pay those patent fees? And it's kind of a unfortunate reality of not having that much money is a lot of things we just have to give up on. You know, the mayonnaise we had to give up on because there's just not enough money to say to do everything. And we have a responsibility. It's in our policy that if we, the university, doesn't develop something, we assign it to the inventor, and they're have a freedom to do whatever they want with it. So it's a money thing. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has gone away from patenting to some extent because in a lot of the tech space changes so quickly that it's easier to do a trade secret. And trade secret just says, here's you and me, here's the invention, you go and make as much money as you can with it, and here's our licensing terms, and when somebody else figures it out, we'll be on to something else, and we'll be making money somewhere on another product. So there are ways around that big cost. And I lost track of the second part of your question.
She did too.
Oh, I was just regular conversations with industry as far as their needs. You mentioned that you've had been approached by industry. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if that's a regular discussion mm-hmm. on a regular basis.
Thank you for the question and through the chair. It is, you know, that is really at that needs assessment that industry, the oil industry is coming in, other companies are coming in, the seafood processors and saying, you know, we need something to do with these pollock skins. What can we do with the pollock skins? And then the university is saying, well, there's fish pet treats. Let's make them into pet treats. And that's something that's going on at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center is pet treat manufacturing. One of the really great cycles that we are in, kind of in a nascent way, but is this cycle where, and this is with Northrop Grumman, for example, we license them some software. And they pay they pay the university to develop software. And they say, okay, we got it. We'll license it to you. That's version one. And then they say, okay, well, now we need version two, so we'll pay you to develop version two. We develop version two, we license that to them. And so now we have this relationship where they're telling us, okay, these are the needs, these are what we want changed. And so that's a cycle that's good for them because they've got a brain trust that knows what they need now and how to develop it. And it's good for us because we have this revenue from licensing and revenue for the research to develop the next product. Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate the presentation, Dr. White. And I think, you know, the university community certainly knows what you're doing, but I'm not sure the regular citizen in Alaska is aware of it. So your idea of celebrating success is really important, and that's going to be not hard to do, but I just think the rest of the state should know what's going on. A couple of sort of questions I had is the requirements of a faculty to teach, to research, to do service. How does that work in the university? How many people do we have doing pure research or just research? Mm. And the other issue is I just made a note. I read an article about somebody's developed wine for cats. I mean, who would have thought that's something we need? But apparently the cats are happy. So so some of these ideas, like your pet treats, those are great. But I guess the real question is, can you tell us a little about the faculty who are committed to research? And how do we, and then, again, how do we get that information out to all of Alaska?
Yeah. Through the chair. The first part of that, faculty have lots of different kinds of appointments, and we have, of course, instructors who just teach, and we have faculty then who have what we would call a two-part contract, where they just teach and do service to the community or service in the university. And then we have a three-part where they have a research component, and that's part of, you know, the state contribution to research. They have time to do that research. And then we have faculty, research faculty, who we only pay for half of the year or some portion of the year, and they're responsible through their grants and contracts of paying the rest of their salary. There are innovators across that spectrum. And really what we've tried to do is identify the early adopters, because there are some faculty who see that as a economic opportunity, but the innovation is not just the research faculty, and I think Dr. Bill Tito is here still. He has taken his class studying using mice, and you would think that you can't take a class that uses mice and make it online learning class, because people have to feed them and do different things, but he's developed the processes to put that online so that students from remote places can sit and do the observations. They can feed the mice. They can do all this from a remote location. So things are being innovated and developed all the time. And it's really a matter, giving the people time, rewarding it, but I think giving them the confidence and saying, you know what, this is a good thing. It's a good thing for the university, because I think at least I know in engineering, kind of in my career, patenting had a negative connotation when I started as a faculty, because it was kind of like, your job as a university is to distribute information widely. That if you're patenting it, that's not good for people. And I realized with that gold thing that it's still not going to be used, because we didn't commercialize it. So, yeah, and I lost the second part of your question.
Well, just can you give me an idea of the number of faculty or how widespread the research is in the university?
Yeah, it varies quite a bit between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. And you know, obviously, 90% rough numbers of the research is done up in Fairbanks, and it's done across the board. And in Robert mentioned the arts; it's done in the arts. Anchorage, yeah, somewhat less so, but there's this really growing, fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done historically, environmental research, which is a strength of UAA, but the health. And the position with the UMED district, I think, is a real promising area. That one of the new NIH high-level, this National Institutes of Health high-level grants is at UAA, and we have great hopes for that. So I think biomedical technologies, a lot of opportunity at UAA.
Madam, just a quick follow-up.
Senator Stevens?
I want to make sure that, it's great for us to hear this information. How what are you going to do to make sure the rest of Alaska learns how important this is to the university's mission?
One of the opportunities I had last night at the Innovation Summit was to do this. I'm also the vice president, the co-chair with Lieutenant Governor Malott of the State Committee on Research. And the State Committee on Research identified this exact thing as a need and said, you know, we're not telling our story, and we're going to start recognizing innovators. Last year, the first inductees, a book was written about them. I've got a copy here I can get you. We're going to celebrate innovations. We're hoping to get these kind of display in the airport that says, here's our innovators. They're not all from the university. In fact, Marcy and Jeff Larson here at Alaska Brewing Company were recognized last night. It was a celebration that I think will help declaring the year of innovation. That, you know, is Robert still here? Because that sounded like a great idea. And that could be coupled with the State Committee on Research, for example.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been a riveting presentation.
Thank you.
You started out by talking about the $25 million roughly that the state invests for research at the university and how that's leveraged into $110 million roughly. And many of us have heard about people, researchers from our universities leaving the state for opportunities elsewhere, concerned about their future and, you know, the lack of stability here. And they take their grants with them. Is that a problem? Do you know what those numbers are? And can you see any trends?
Yeah, through the chair. It is a big concern. You know, I think that the by and large, it's not exclusively this way, but by and large, if a faculty leaves, their grants leave with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is well known that across the country that we are having financial challenges in Alaska. Unfortunately for us, the rest of the country had their recession already and they're hiring. It's also true that universities across the country are developing Arctic research programs because they see the interest in Alaska, in the Arctic, and they see the opportunity funding available. So there is a blossoming of Arctic programs across the country, and they all need faculty, and they're all looking to Alaska. So, you know, it is a concern. I think there have been faculty that have left. And, you know, the president just spoke at a chamber over lunch, and his point was we've got to do everything we can to, A, support the faculty, B, keep the faculty here. You know, most faculty came here because they wanted to be here, and this is a great place for them to do that. And I think we have a responsibility to maintain an environment that is rewarding for them, because if it isn't, there are lots of opportunities.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Senator Gardner, for your question. Any other questions from committee members? Dr. White, I want to thank you very much for taking time to come speak with the Labor and Commerce Committee here in the Senate. And as I mentioned earlier, we have been dovetailing with the Innovation Summit here in Juneau. And I think your presentation was very enlightening. And anything that we can do to help highlight the innovations and the great work that you're doing, let us know. And so thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll take a brief at ease while we wait for our next presenters to come to the table. Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today we have a very special presentation. And we have two students from Sand Lake Elementary School, which is in my district in Anchorage. And I want to welcome Nora and Gwyneth. Welcome. So Nora and Gwyneth are both involved in First Lego League, and for those members who are not familiar with the program, it's a competition where student teams are they're assessed on their robot design, their project, and then also teamwork. And so with us today, we have Nora and Gwyneth. They are members of different teams from Sand Lake Elementary School that come out of Sand Lake Elementary School. And Nora will be describing her team's project because they won the Global Innovator Award. So she will be describing her team's project. And then Gwyneth brought with us, or with her today, her team's Lego robot, and she is with the Sand Lake Lions. So welcome. Or excuse me, I think I have that messed up. You're with the Sand Lake Lions and you're with the Samurai. So
we've combined together.
Oh, your robot is together?
We share everything now.
Okay, great.
Because we had to split into two teams because we had more than 10 people.
Okay. So the way it works then is you'll speak into the microphone and then say your name and go ahead and if you want to walk us through, Nora, your project. And we'll hand you this.
I have to say the introduction. Ohayou gozaimasu. Watashi konnichiwa. Watashi tachi wa Sandoreku Lions desu. Good afternoon. We are the Sand Lake Lions. My name is Gwyneth.
My name is Nora. We're going to be showing you the hot dog collar. We're from First Lego League team. We're the Sand Lake Lions, and this year's project is Animal Allies, Human and Animal Interaction. How we came up with our project was we invited guest speakers from all over, and we came up with 70 different project ideas, and then we voted on the projects to take on and solve. We chose dogs in hot and cold cars.
The problem is that each year thousands of dogs out of the United States die from the heat and cold. The worst is when they die in cars.
Many people run errands with their dogs because their dogs like being in cars. Most stores don't allow pets in them.
Don't let the temperature trick you. Pet owners underestimate how dangerous leaving a dog in a car can be. Don't bother cracking the window because it's going to hardly make a difference. A dog's normal temperature is 102 Fahrenheit, 102.5 degrees, and 104 degrees, they're in danger.
On a 75 degree day, in just 10 minutes, the temperature in the car can rise to 94 degrees. In 30 minutes, 109 degrees.
Have you ever gone to the store to get one thing really quickly and ran into a friend and start talking?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In a hot car, dogs can show signs of heat exhaustion quickly. Heat exhaustion can lead to heat stroke. Heat stroke can eventually lead to death.
Some symptoms of heat exhaustion in dogs are heavy panting, excessive drooling, a rise in body temperature, and increased heart rate.
The collar will measure the dog's temperature using prongs that touch the dog's skin. When the temperature hits the dangerous level, the collar will send a text alert to your cell phone. There are several different collars that we have found recently that measure the ambient air temperature, but ours would measure the dog's body temperature. The other collars have a limited range of 1,000 feet. The other collars don't work in cars.
The collar would also work if the dog got too cold instead of hot.
Monitors the dog's body temperature using probes that contact the skin under their fur. Sends a text alert to the owner's phone if the dog's body temperature gets too hot or too cold. If no internet connection, the collar itself will make an alarm. We want to make it waterproof. Different sizes, boxes for small and large dogs. Internet connection, data connections, wireless battery charging, and different collar options.
Here's a prototype for the hot collar. The prongs would be on the back of the box.
It's not gonna look exactly.
The cost would be around $50 to $60, and there would also be a GPS just in case the dog ran away.
These are our expert presenters. Do you have any questions?
Well, first of all, I'm going to do a round of applause for you. That was just really wonderful and so creative. I want to thank you for coming here. I know you were recognized down at the Innovation Summit. And my question for you is, are you actually planning to bring your idea to the commercial market?
Yes.
Okay. And how are you actually going? How are you doing that? Are you getting a grant or of some kind from the winning the award?
We might get one, but if we don't, I don't know. My dad might make it because there's a 3D printer at Mears, which is a school in Anchorage, and my dad can program it, so maybe my dad can do it. But if we do get a, we can get a grant.
Yeah.
If we win out of the world, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, good luck to you. Are there any questions that anyone has? Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a collar for my dog that's an electric collar for paging him. And it seems to me that this could be added to these features that you've suggested could be added to an existing collar system. And there's already kind of connection between the part I carry and the part that the dog wears. Have you thought about that?
Not really. But we could add it.
Well, you might be able to work with the manufacturer of those kind of collars that are already doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Very nice.
Well, thank you very much. I also wanted to mention that the LEGO Robotics teams are supported by coaches, and with them today is Richard Geiger, who's the assistant coach of the team, and then Greg Phillips, who's here. He's a teacher and coach for the Sand Lake Elementary School. So welcome, and thank you for supporting our young people. I think the LEGO Robotics program is, you know, a fabulous learning opportunity, and I wish you girls both the best of luck as you move on, and I hope you're going to be on a team next year. Are you planning to?
Yes.
Yeah. How many teams does Sand Lake Elementary School have?
Two.
Currently.
Great.
Last year it was one.
Okay. This is the first time Sand Lake's ever had a
team. Oh, really? Wonderful. Senator Hughes.
Are you able to turn your Lego contraption on? Does it have power, or...
Yes, but it's very specific to a table that was designed for we designed the robot on. But I guess we could turn it on and it'll probably run into things.
We can probably put it on the floor.
Yeah.
If we do the dog.
It's
a dog. We can do the dog one.
So, Nora, do you want to explain to the committee members the table and how you get to choose your missions and what you want your robot to do, and then how you earn points for the robot design, well, performance, but also for the robot design, how you design the robot and program it? No?
Okay. You take different Legos and... First of all, you want a stable robot, unlike my robot. This isn't my robot. My robot was long and skinny, and you want it to be more boxy like theirs.
Huh?
And you want it to be fast. So,
this one isn't very fast.
Program it fast.
Okay. Gwyneth, did you, of all the different missions that you you had the opportunity to complete, how many of the missions did your robot... your particular team's robot complete?
There's so many, very many missions on even one contraption. So about maybe half.
Great.
That we tried to do.
Great. Well, that's wonderful.
That we programmed. There's just so many.
Wonderful. Any other questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you again for coming, and I wish you the best of luck in your teams next year, and want to thank your coach and your teacher for being here with you. So with that, committee's adjourned.